I'm Jenny.
Hi, I'm Scott.
Welcome to episode 6 of the Reading Envy podcast,
where we'll have what you're reading.
Yeah, and we're doing something a little bit different today. The Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction is going to be announced on June 4th.
Yeah.
And so we're going to talk about the shortlist for that prize.
Okay. Yep. And it's just you and I today.
Yes.
And actually, you are the only one who has read the books.
Yes.
So we're just going to talk about these books, and I'm excited. So yeah. The Bailey's Women's Prize. Do you have Bailey's with you right now?
I don't. That would have been a really smart idea, you know, brought to you by Bailey's.
Exactly. Bailey's Irish Cream.
And it is the same company.
That is cool.
This used to be the Orange Prize for Fiction, and the people that used to fund it stopped. And so Bailey's picked it up this past year. This is the first time that I think the prize will be a Bailey's prize.
Ah. Did the people that used to fund it, were they the orange growers of Florida? Where did the orange of the Orange Prize come from? Was somebody's last name, maybe?
I don't know. It has to be somewhere in the UK, right?
Yeah. And this is in the UK. We should note that too, right?
Well, it's founded there, but I don't think... Let me think about this for a minute. No, it's just, it has to be... Let's look it up, because I'm not sure what
the website
qualifications
here.
Are. It's women's writing throughout the world, so it's not limited to region.
Okay, it says, the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction is awarded annually to the woman who, in the opinion of the judges, has written the best eligible full-length novel in English. So it doesn't say... Okay, a little bit farther down, it says, the prize is open to any full-length novel written in English by a woman of any nationality, provided that the novel is published for the first time in print form in the United Kingdom between 1 April of the year before the prize is awarded and 31 March of the year in which the prize is awarded.
Right.
So it needs to be published in the UK.
Right. And so the funny thing about that is that there are often books that aren't yet available in the United States, 2 out of the 6 for the shortlist. That's true for. And then sometimes a book may be a year or more old in the United States, but has just been published over there. So due to the weird international publishing rules and changes, some books will seem old and some will probably be unknown depending on where you live.
Okay.
And I looked at the history, and the award has only been around since the 90s, and it happened after a year that the Booker Prize ended up with no women on the list, and people got together and were like, this is just not good. So it was just a very intentional way to bring attention to female writers.
Okay. Good All thing right. then. You betcha.
Yeah. And, you know, I really like to read lists of books. And so this prize, I've read at least the shortlist for the last few years because I always have authors on here I've never read before. They do a really good job at picking a diverse group. So I think there will be a few authors on here that may be unfamiliar to people as well. It's at least, I think half of them, it's their first novel. So,
well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So you say they're good at picking a diverse group, but do you think the quality is good? Obviously, yeah, if you keep reading the list, yeah.
Yeah. So I would say I knew more from the long list. I had read about half of them already between the Booker list and the Tournament of Books list. A lot of them were also on those. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these had quite a bit of acclaim. But some of the books they selected for the short list were definitely unknown to me.
Okay. And the Booker Prize, is that also an English prize?
Yes, although that one, until this next year, has been limited to the British Empire.
Oh, interesting.
And former, you know, so like Canada, South Africa, the UK, and Ireland. But this next year, it's going to be open to the United States as well, which I think is going to change the award quite a bit.
Yeah, you would think so.
I mean, much of the publishing world is in the United States, so it was kind of nice to leave it out, you know.
Sure, yeah.
But we'll see.
Okay. Interesting. All right.
Yeah.
So let's see the short list. I'll just go through this list really quickly.
Sure.
The short list is made up of 6 books. I'm just going to read the list in the order given on the website. Okay. The first one is called Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, I hope. Burial Rites by Hannah Kent. Pretty sure I got that name correct. The Lowland by Jhumpa Lahiri. The Undertaking by Audrey McGee. A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing by Eimear McBride. Is that like a Welsh name maybe or something?
Irish.
Irish, okay. And The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. So those are the six books. Are those the six books that you read?
They are.
Oh, what luck. Okay, good.
That's good luck.
And oh, two perfect. Of them
I had to order from Amazon UK.
Ooh, which two?
A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing by Eimear McBride and The Undertaking by Audrey McGee. They don't come out here until September.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's talk about them.
Great.
Okay, we'll start with The Lowland by Jhumpa Lahiri.
Okay.
Okay, I'm just going to read the publisher's blurb here. Two brothers, bound by tragedy, a fiercely brilliant woman haunted by her past, a country torn by revolution, a powerful new novel set in both India and America that explores the price of idealism and a love that can last long past death. Growing up in Calcutta, just born just 15 months apart, Subhash and Udayan Mitra are inseparable brothers, one often mistaken for the other. But they are also opposites with gravely different futures ahead of them. It is the 1960s, and Udayan, charismatic and impulsive, finds himself drawn to the Naxalite movement, a rebellion waged to eradicate inequality and poverty. He will give everything, risk all, for what he believes. Subhash, the dutiful son, does not share his brother's political passion. He leaves home to pursue a life of scientific research in a quiet coastal corner of America. But when Subhash learns what happened to his brother in the lowland outside their family's home, he comes back to India, hoping to pick up the pieces of a shattered family and to heal the wounds Udayan left behind, including those seared in the heart of his brother's wife. Suspenseful, sweeping, piercingly intimate, The Lowland expands the range of one of our most dazzling storytellers, seamlessly interweaving the historical and the personal across generations and geographies. This masterly novel of fate and will, exile and return, is a tour de force and an instant classic. Interesting.
Yeah. Have you read any books by Jhumpa Lahiri?
Yes. I read, she had a short story collection that won a Pulitzer one year. Trying to recall what the name of it is. I'll look it up really fast, but I really liked it. Interpreter of Maladies.
Oh, okay. Interpreter of Maladies. Yeah, that was her early book of short stories. I think that's the first book of hers I've read too. I think I've read them all. And she does tend to talk a lot about the immigrant experience, always Indian characters, and often the conflict between the old world and the new world, not just living in a different place, but having parents that come from one and children that are in the other.
Yeah.
So I'm used to that from her. I think this book, the interesting parts to me were everything about the Naxalite movement, which I knew nothing about, and just the landscape outside of Calcutta. I marked a page from the pretty, like page five, very near the beginning, just to give an example of the landscape.
Can I
read that really quick?
Yeah, excellent.
Oh, here we are. Oh, sorry, I lost my spot. Okay, some of the government workers had received homes in the exchange program, but most were refugees arriving in waves, stripped of their ancestral land, a rapid trickle, then a flood. A few bundles on their heads, infants strapped to parents' chests. They made shelters of canvas or thatch, walls of woven bamboo. They lived without sanitation, without electricity, in shanties next to garbage heaps, in any available space. They were the reason that Adi Ganja, on the banks of which the Tali Club stood, was now a sewer canal for southwest Calcutta. They were the reason for the club's additional walls. So, you know, it goes on to describe the really unbalanced classes in India as well. And that's where the brothers grew up. And so his brother became a revolutionary and he became a scholar, which he said in the description. And so they have very different lives from the very beginning. And he marries his brother's wife once she's widowed and brings her back to America. So Udayan has gone, and his wife is still kind of in her mind, very much a part of Indian culture. Subhash has been there for so long, it's, you know, second nature to him. And she's very isolated, and she's pregnant, which, you know, you don't find that out for a while. So it's kind of that story, just in a different way. Most of the time, Lahiri writes about the children of people growing up, and there is a daughter in this novel. But I thought the most interesting story was the wife. I mean, you're so isolated when you're the wife of an academic. So she had to try to create her own little group in Rhode Island, I think, is the state that they live in. But honestly, this is probably not my most favorite Lahiri book. Most of the characters were very cold to me. I just didn't care about them as much as I wanted to. I don't know. Part of it is that I was listening in audio, and I sometimes that's just not the best way to experience every book.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. Did Subhash's wife go with him back to India?
Well, he went to India to get her.
Okay. I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
The brother that dies is the revolutionary in the Naxalite movement.
Right.
And so that's, he's in India when he dies.
Okay.
And at that point, his brother has already moved to the United States to go to school and to do research and to teach.
Mm-hmm.
So their lives are very different.
Yeah. Yeah. Very.
But, you know, it's interesting to hear about the 1960s, you know, in both countries. There's a lot of parallel there. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It says, suspenseful, sweeping, and piercingly intimate. Do you agree with that description?
No.
Okay. That's interesting.
I don't find it to be intimate at all. That was what I wish it had been.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to get more into their heads, all of them. But I liked the historical context of it. I think that's missing in quite a few for other novels. I mean, it's not so much missing as it's not the focus.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Okay, and it takes place mostly in the 60s, it says, so they're adults in the 60s.
Yeah. I mean, it is sweeping in a few generations because the daughter grows up and comes back home, so you follow that story throughout, too. Mm. But, you know, the novel's only 340 pages, so if you're going to be sweeping but also be short, it's difficult to be intimate. I mean, those are choices that you make.
Yeah, it's hard to be all of it.
Right.
That's right. So it's not your favorite Lahiri book, but you still liked it quite a bit. Is that a decent assessment?
Yeah, she's a good writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really did enjoy what I read of her. And if you were going to read or recommend one of her novels, what would you recommend?
Well, I really do like The Namesake.
The Namesake, okay.
But I do, that's my favorite novel of hers, but I think her short stories are where she really shines.
Does she have more collections than the one I read?
Yeah, I think Unaccustomed Earth is the more recent story volume.
Yeah, maybe I'll pick that up.
Yeah.
All right, I'll write that down. All right, now next up is one called The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt.
Yes.
Excuse me. So I'll read the intro to this one. It begins with a boy. Theo Decker, a 13-year-old New Yorker, miraculously survives an accident that kills his mother. Abandoned by his father, Theo is taken in by the family of a wealthy friend. Bewildered by his strange new home on Park Avenue, disturbed by schoolmates who don't know how to talk to him, and tormented above all by his unbearable longing for his mother, he clings to the one thing that reminds him of her, a small, mysteriously captivating painting that ultimately draws Theo into the underworld of art. As an adult, Theo moves silkily between the drawing rooms of the rich and the dusty labyrinth of an antique store where he works. He is alienated and in love, and at the center of a narrowing, ever more dangerous circle. The Goldfinch is a novel of shocking narrative energy and power. It combines unforgettably vivid characters, mesmerizing language, and breathtaking suspense while plumbing with a philosopher's calm the deepest mysteries of love, identity, and art. It is a beautiful, stay up all night and tell your friends triumph, an old-fashioned story of loss and obsession, survival and self-invention, and the ruthless machinations of fate.
Wow, publishers write really heavy copy today.
Yeah, apparently these are both the very best books ever. No,
they always are.
Yeah.
I read this book over Christmas break, I think. I remember having a lot of downtime when I read it, but you know, it's almost 800 pages, but it goes really, really quickly. Did you read The Da Vinci Code?
Yeah, I did.
People are going to hate me for saying this. I just had a very similar experience to reading this that I did when I read that, in the way where there's not really a mystery, but you know, the chapters are really short and you move from place to place really quickly and it makes you curious about art. So you're looking stuff up on the internet a lot. In that sense, it really reminded me of that reading experience. I do think that Donna Tartt is a more eloquent writer. And she does try to be, what did the publisher say, philosophical, mm-hmm. probing the deep mysteries of love. Mm-hmm. and I think people are really not in agreement about whether or not that part of the book is effective. For me, I liked those parts, and those were the parts I marked, but I'm not sure they fit into the book the way the tone was. Like, okay, I'll read you a little bit.
Okay.
That I was so haunted, suggested ominously, a love more binding than physical affection, some tar pit of the soul where I might flop around and malinger for years. So, you know, it's very kind of elevated language, but this is the main character, Theo. And you care about him and you want him to be okay because obviously you've lived through the experience with him of his mother dying in this awful museum bombing. But he's a criminal and a murderer. And there's this one point where he's walking around covered in blood. You know, so it's kind of a weird experience, I guess, to have these very deep thoughts, but this very criminal character.
At 13 years old, no less, right? He's 13 years old throughout most of the book.
No.
Oh, sorry. It begins with him 13. Yeah. I'm sorry. So he's an adult, right?
Yeah, it quickly
jumps. And it says that right there.
Yeah, well, it's hard to tell just from the description. I mean, he has to find his way as a child first. But yeah, it does jump pretty much into the future for him. There's also, the description doesn't talk about this at all, but there's this little girl in the museum. And she is a thread throughout the novel as well.
She was in the museum when the accident took place?
Yeah, he noticed her before the bomb happened. I don't think it's spoiling much to say it's a bomb. It happens so early on. And then he has something that he wants to give her. And so that kind of is this thread throughout the whole story. I liked that part a lot. And I was really curious about what would happen with that.
So as an adult, he's got something that he wants to give to her. So he's looking for her.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of neat.
And that's kind of what makes other things happen that bring it all back around.
Hmm.
So I enjoyed it.
Good. Yeah. Donna Tartt is a name that I have not heard before. Is this her first?
No, she's an American writer. Uh-huh. I think she's Southern, actually, because the two other novels I know of hers, I think, are set in the South. At least it's The Little Friend and The Secret History are the two I know, and that there may be others. But The Little Friend is set in Louisiana and starts with a boy being murdered at like a family picnic. That's as far as I got in that book. I started it and didn't finish. But she does tend to write some suspenseful kind of thriller type things, but in a literary way. And it's a nice combination, I think.
Interesting. Yeah. It's interesting how long it is between her books. Looks like The Secret History was 1992. And then the next one, her second novel, was 2002.
Wow.
And then this one is 2013.
Yeah, almost exactly 10 years. I wonder if she does a lot of research or what she's doing in between.
Yeah, I don't know.
Hmm. Well, but it probably takes a while to write a novel this long.
Yeah. Oh, it's a big one. Yeah, 771. That's right.
Yeah, and a lot of people have been talking about this book. I feel like it was on one of the other lists. I think it was on at least in the tournament of books. But I'm just not sure how memorable it is in the end. I don't think that the brief parts of philosophy really save it to make it, you know, that kind of elevated book. Mm-hmm. I've really enjoyed it along the way, but I'm not sure I would read it again.
Well, it looks she won the Pulitzer for it.
Did she?
The Goldfinch has won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for fiction.
Wow, I conveniently forgot that one. Because I was just like, really? Oh, okay. You know, that's kind of how I felt about it. Like, You know, it's very readable, but to me, a great book is one that you immediately want to pick up and read again. But that's my kind of criteria.
Cool.
But I think most people would enjoy it.
It sounds enjoyable to me. That sounds like something that I would like.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that? Or?
I think so.
Okay. I think I'm going to put that down.
Yeah. And even when he's the criminal and you're rooting for him, there's these great scenes in Amsterdam that I think were the most vivid. And it's probably near the end of the novel.
All right. Well, that sounds really good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's see. Next up, we've got Burial Rites by Hannah Kent. A brilliant literary debut inspired by a true story, the final days of a young woman accused of murder in Iceland in 1829. Set against Iceland's stark landscape, Hannah Kent brings to vivid life the story of Agnes, who, charged with the brutal murder of her former master, is sent to an isolated farm to await execution. Horrified at the prospect of housing a convicted murderer, the family at first avoids Agnes. Only Toti, a priest Agnes has mysteriously chosen to be her spiritual guardian, seeks to understand her. But as Agnes's death looms, the farmer's wife and their daughters learn that there is another side to this sensational story they've heard. Riveting and rich with lyricism, this last paragraph in all of these is like, this is awesome. Okay. Burial Rites evokes a dramatic existence in a distant time and place and asks the question, how can one woman hope to endure when her life depends upon the stories told by others? What did you think of this one?
Well, I had completely different expectations for the book than what it became. I guess I should explain it. I thought it would somehow be this anti-death penalty thinly veiled novel. You know, it kind of sounds like that's what it's going to be. Instead, it's really just historical fiction about a very real person who actually existed, but the historical accounts are completely conflicting on her. Some people think she was a witch and evil and a murderer, and some people think that she was, hung without reason. So the author isn't Icelandic herself, but she visited there in college and heard the story and kept going back. And so she did a lot of research and found these conflicting accounts and thought, you know, I'm going to write a novel about what if she wasn't really guilty? You know, what would that story be? So it was really interesting to read. And I've been trying to read books set in Iceland this year, so it was really good timing for me.
Oh, cool.
But that also gave me some good context for the book because I've dabbled a little bit in the sagas. And for a long time, I thought sagas were just mythic poems kind of things. But they're actually historical accounts in Icelanders' eyes. And there's some definite parallels there. The hero's journey, you know.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Heroic characters, the people that become legends, and her story has that kind of feeling to it. But, you know, it's only from 1829, 26, something like that, 1829.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a unique period in Icelandic history because most of the time, because they were actually ruled by Denmark, anyone who was a criminal and being charged with anything, they would go through their trial in Denmark. And then if they were going to be put to murder or jailed, that would also happen in Denmark. So it was strange for these people to be jailed. They were put in people's homes. So she lived with a family who was terrified of her at first. And then, of course, she becomes part of the family. But she's being charged for the murder of two men. And it's clear that they're going to put her to death no matter what happens. So that's kind of already decided. And so the story is more about her life in her last year, her relationship with the priest, her relationship with the family, and just that whole landscape of people barely making a living, barely sustaining themselves in a kind of desolate place, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one thing I've noticed about Icelandic literature, and I don't know, I've not lived in historic Iceland, but all I know from all the books is that it must have just smelled awful. Because authors take so much time to really tell you how things smell. Whale blubber and peat and smoke. And okay, so there's this little quote I have. I was so happy to be desired when the smell of him, of sulfur and crushed herbs and horse sweat and the smoke from his forge made me dizzy with pleasure. And you're like, really? Dizzy with something.
Wow.
There were a lot of moments in there where she really kind of hammered home the smells.
Smells, but interesting.
I thought that was kind of funny.
So despite it not being what you thought it would be at the beginning anyway, it does sound like you enjoyed this one as well.
I did, and I think I liked it more. I think if it had just been kind of a preachy novel, I wouldn't have enjoyed it as much.
Yeah.
It wasn't that at all. It was really just kind of the story of this one historic person. And I'm really fascinated by Iceland in general because they've always been so very literate. There's even this whole set of poets known as the farmer poets. I just really appreciate that. And it's so part of their culture. Even in this story, these very poor people, they all read and some of them write. So I just like that part of it.
It's probably cold there.
It is. They need something to do with all the darkness.
Yeah, and it's dark, right?
Yes. They have a phrase. It's in the book, so I'm going to try to pronounce it. Blinder e boklas mor, or mathor, mathor, I think. Blind is a man without a book.
I like it.
Yeah.
Like it very much.
And this is one of those first novels, too.
Yes, right. Yeah.
So Hannah Kent is,
a literary debut.
Has a lot of promise. Yeah.
That's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good for her. It must be really something to end up on a list like this.
Absolutely.
Right out of the gate. Very nice. Yeah, that sounds like something I would enjoy as well. It really does.
It's a really good one.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I'm not sure how much we should say about Americana.
Yeah.
Because it was my picks for one of our...
It was. But yeah, let's recap it really quick, though.
Okay.
So Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And I feel like I should apologize to her every time I say that name. From the award-winning author of Half a Yellow Sun, a dazzling new novel, a story of love and race centered around a young man and woman from Nigeria who face difficult choices and challenges in the countries they come to call home. As teenagers in a Lagos secondary school, oh boy, Ifemelu and Obinzi fall in love.
Ifemelu
and Obinzi fall in love. Their Nigeria is under military dictatorship and people are leaving the country if they can. Ifemelu, beautiful, self-assured, departs for America to study. She suffers defeats and triumphs, finds and loses relationships and friendships, all the while feeling the weight of something she never thought of back home, race. Obinzi, the quiet, thoughtful son of a professor, had hoped to join her, but post-9/11 America would not let him in, and he plunges into a dangerous, undocumented life in London. Years later, Obinzi is a wealthy man in a newly democratic Nigeria, while Ifemelu, I think I pronounce that different every time I say it, has achieved success as a writer of an eye-opening blog about race in America. But when Ifemelu returns to Nigeria, she and Obinzi reignite their shared passion for their homeland and for each other. They will face the toughest decisions of their lives. And now the last paragraph, fearless, gripping, at once darkly funny and tender, spanning three continents and numerous lives, Americana is a richly told story set in today's globalized world. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's most powerful and astonishing novel yet. Now, I remember when we talked about it, can't remember what episode it was. Two, I think, maybe?
Four.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Four. When we talked about it then, you said the most striking thing to you was the experience of a Nigerian amongst, in America, amongst people of our own race, and still feeling like an outsider.
Right. The whole African black versus non-African black.
Correct. Right.
Issue. Yeah. And you know, this is one of those times where that last paragraph, I actually think I agree with it.
All right.
Fearless, gripping, funny, and tender. I don't know if it's her best novel because I haven't read her others. Mm-hmm. So that's still something I need to do. But yeah, we did talk about it in, episode 4. I also had this selected, the whole reason I read it to begin with was it was for a book club. So I've talked about it there. I've talked about it on the podcast and I haven't stopped thinking about this book.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. Like I think it's better and better the more I think about it and the more I read other things. I had read another book about a person from Nigeria that goes back to Nigeria. And I was constantly comparing it to this book in my head. Mm-hmm. Since we've already kind of discussed it, but you know, not everyone maybe heard that, I thought I would read a few excerpts.
Okay, great.
If that's okay.
Of course it is, yeah.
Because I think it's really interesting, the different tones in the book. Like you said, Ifemelu has a blog and she becomes very popular because of that. And it's probably the most honest that the author can be too. So I have a kind of longer excerpt from that, and then I have an example of what the narrative sounds like, because I think they're very different.
Great.
So here's from the blog. The only reason you say that race was not an issue is because you wish it was not. We all wish it was not, but it's a lie. I came from a country where race was not an issue. I did not think of myself as black, and I only became black when I came to America. When you are black in America and you fall in love with a white person, race doesn't matter when you're alone together because it's just you and your love. But the minute you step outside, race matters. But we don't talk about it. We don't even tell our white partners the small things that piss us off and the things we wish they understood better, because we're worried they will say we're overreacting or we're being too sensitive. And we don't want them to say, look how far we've come. Just 40 years ago, it would have been illegal for us to even be a couple, blah, blah, blah. Because you know what we're thinking when they say that? We're thinking, why the fuck should it have ever been illegal anyway? But we don't say any of this stuff. We let it pile up inside our heads. And when we come to nice liberal dinners like this, we say that race doesn't matter because that's what we're supposed to say to keep our nice liberal friends comfortable. It's true. I speak from experience.
Wow.
So, you know, she's very blunt in those posts in particular. Mm-hmm. And in the novel, Ifemelu is academic. And so she has to be in these circles. And at first these people don't know that she has this blog and she's the most honest in those days, you know? Mm-hmm. And then just a little bit from the novel itself. I mean, the blog posts are part of the novel, but they're very distinct and you know when they're happening because they're a different font and everything. Mm-hmm. And this is a description of Ifemelu when she's thinking about going back to Nigeria. There was cement in her soul. It had been there for a while, an early morning disease of fatigue, shapeless desires, brief imaginary glints of other lives she could be living, that over the months melded into a piercing homesickness.
Wow. That's beautiful. Yeah. That's nice.
It is. Mm. And so I think the writing is wonderful. I think it's very modern, very current. It talks about a lot of things that I don't think we've resolved in the United States yet. So I just think this is a great book.
Cool. Yeah, I avoid racial stuff myself mostly because I feel like, you know, even trying to discuss it, it just proves I don't really understand.
Yeah.
And how could I possibly understand? But that's one of the values of fiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's helping you understand others.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So all these are winners so far, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The next one up is, excuse me, The Undertaking by Audrey McGee. Desperate to escape the Eastern Front, Peter Faber, an ordinary German soldier, marries Katharina Spinell, a woman he has never met. It is a marriage of convenience that promises honeymoon leave for him and a pension for her, should he die on the front. With 10 days leave secured, Peter visits his new wife in Berlin. Both are surprised by the attraction that develops between them. When Peter returns to the horror of the front, it is only the dream of Katerina that it sustains him as he approaches Stalingrad. Back in Berlin, Katerina, goaded on by her desperate and delusional parents, ruthlessly works her way into the Nazi party hierarchy, wedding herself, her young husband, and their unborn child to the regime. But when the tide of war turns and Berlin falls, Peter and Katerina, ordinary people stained with their small share of an extraordinary guilt, find their simple dream of family increasingly hard to hold on to. No last paragraph in that one.
Yeah, I may have not put it in there.
Oh, okay.
You know, when I saw this on the list, I kind of groaned to myself. I get burned out on World War II, but this is definitely a different take on it. We don't often see the Nazi side of things, for one thing. I did read a novel last year called City of Women about Berlin, because there were no men left, unless they were children, because everyone had to be, you know, in the war.
Right.
And that one was interesting. And this one has the people in Berlin, and then it alternates with the chapters and the people on the front. So definitely a different perspective. And I actually, before I say much more, I have an excerpt I want to read. And I just want to warn you that it takes a minute to figure out what's going on. So just bear with me.
Okay.
And this is like from page 42. They stepped into a large hall, its ceiling heavy with white sculpted plaster. Mr. Spinell rubbed his shoes against the back of his legs and stepped onto the red patterned carpet covering the staircase. The women followed. Katerina squealed at its softness. Her mother bent down to touch the rails and rods. Solid brass, Gunther. She turned the key and they entered a square hallway with a gilt-edged mirror and a white marble bust. Two glass doors led to the living room with polished wooden floors, a grand piano, sofas, rugs, paintings, and alcoves lined with leather-bound books. "It's beautiful," said Katerina. "Finally," said Mrs. Spinell, "a proper home." The two women threw off their shoes and rushed around the apartment, laughing as they opened doors onto enormous bedrooms and balconies. The kitchen drawers were stacked with equipment for slicing and beating, and cupboards filled with starched linen sheets, tablecloths, napkins, and huge soft towels, still perfectly white. "They had everything," said Katerina. "We had nothing," said Mrs. Spinell. They converged again in the living room, telling Mr. Spinell about the bathtub big enough for two, but he was focused on the alcoves, cursing loudly and throwing books onto the floor. "Rubbish, rubbish. These will have to go before we can sleep a night in this house." "Any jewelry?" asked Mr. Spinell. "No," said Katerina, "not that I can see. Bloody thieves, the lot of them. They swallow it, you know, to hide it from us." He piled his arms with books and headed for the front door. "Take your things off the cart. I need it." He dumped the books into the cart, the covers splaying as they fell. "Wait here. I'll fetch the rest. Make sure nobody takes any of them. They're corrosive, every one of them." He disappeared back up the stairs and returned with more books and the marble bust. "Not the statue, Gunther," said Mrs. Spinell. "It suits the hall. It's Mendelssohn, Esther." I'm going to skip down a little bit. On her way to the linen cupboard, she caught sight of her mother in a red woolen dress. "You look lovely, mother, but it's Jewish. I can't possibly wear it." It continues.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
The Spinells are a Nazi family, and the father and the brother, the work that they do is remove people who are Jewish from their homes. And they get to move into this beautiful home. And that kind of sets the stage for the life that Peter and Katerina have together. It's little things like that. Almost the entire novel is dialogue. There isn't a lot of description. And so it's almost like the impact hits you a little bit later, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Because you're reading about what they're saying about things, but you kind of have to read between the lines. And there's a lot of really terrible things going on. But they are just treating it like it's their normal life. So
wow.
I think that's where the power of it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it seemed that's so difficult. Yeah.
It's very
what
hard.
What a time in history that is. I still haven't gotten tired of reading about World War II myself. I do enjoy World War II things. I mean, I'm interested in it, I guess I'd say.
Sure.
Yeah. Still an amazing period of history for me.
Yeah, and I thought the author's background, the more I read about her, it kind of filled in some gaps in the novel for me, because mm-hmm. she's actually a journalist and she has been a war correspondent in Bosnia and Ireland. And I think she saw the front and the things that happened in Berlin as an example of how war still is and how there's all these mundane things that happened. And she calls it mundane horrors. That's her phrase. I actually really like that.
Things
that we
horrors,
normalize, huh? Mundane horrors.
Wow.
And people do terrible things to each other, but we somehow, you know, make it like it's our everyday life. So
yeah.
She intentionally wrote that into this book. I mean, she didn't have to write it into it. It's part of history, but you know.
And this is her first.
It is.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Says she works for 12 years as a journalist and has written for The Times, The Irish Times, The Observer, and The Guardian.
Yeah,
nice.
She's done a lot. And she is Irish, too. So she wrote about that first while she lived there.
Hmm.
And it sounds very, I don't know, kind of almost romantic, but it really isn't romantic. If you think about the Nazi belief system and what they required from women, the reason that she's marrying this person she's never met
mm-hmm.
is to have Nazi babies.
Ah, yes.
You know, perpetuate the race. So even that,
and what is
never mentioned.
What does Peter Faber think of that? Is he?
Well, he wants to get married because it's the only way he gets a break from the front.
I see.
And they will award people that get married because they want them to perpetuate the race. But you have to kind of read between the lines of that one, too. You don't figure that out at first. Like, I wasn't thinking about that because it just starts with them in their different places. He's on the front and she's in Berlin, and they have this simultaneous wedding kind of by proxy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then they meet each other and he's completely filthy and lice ridden. And it's just this really gross, disgusting scene. And he's lower class than her. And so the family is very standoffish. But, you know,
uh-huh.
it's all kind of on the surface. And then they move into this beautiful house and then he goes back to the war.
And then as a soldier, is he okay with what's going on, or is he? Well, it says here that he's, you know, he's horrified by the front.
Well, it's just because it's really hard to live there. They uh-huh. felt abandoned. You know, it's mm-hmm. in October and after that when their food lines get cut off.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they're starving, and there's a conflict for him near the end about that I wouldn't want to ruin for anyone. But they can see the soldiers on the other side, and they can see that they have food. And that they're warm and they have fire. And these are things that he does not have.
Wow.
So it's a very difficult situation. And he, you know, he just does what he's told. And war is kind of like that, right? You're just in your little tiny space doing little tiny everyday things you're told to do, but you don't see the bigger picture when you're in it.
Yeah.
And I think she communicates that pretty well.
Oh, well, that's great.
Yeah.
Wow. Another good one. And you enjoyed this as well, right?
Yeah, I had to think about it for a while, I think, mm-hmm. to really understand what she was doing. Because it would be easy to read it just on the surface level and for it not to kind of sink in.
Uh-huh.
But that's more of a stylistic thing.
And once it sunk in, it meant something to you, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's
definitely.
Neat. I love that. Mm-hmm. That makes me happy when a book does that.
Definitely. And you can tell she researched it. All these little tiny details that she has were things that she actually came across, which I just appreciate that.
Yeah, I do too. Well, now that book's on my list because that sounds like something I would like as well.
Yeah. This is why we read books from
Holy lists, cow.
Because they've already, you know, vetted them for us.
Yeah. When I read books on lists, it's fun how you kind of break out of your normal stuff.
Oh yeah.
And I think absolutely. That's what is really great about it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I believe this is the last one, right? Mm-hmm. This is called A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing by, I think you said Emer?
Oh, I just guessed.
Emer? Okay. E-I. Emer? Yeah. E-I-M-E-A-R. I'll call it Emer McBride. Emer McBride's debut tells, with astonishing insight and in brutal detail, the story of a young woman's relationship with her brother and the long shadow cast by his childhood brain tumor. Not so much a stream of consciousness as an unconscious railing against a life that makes little sense, and a shocking and intimate insight into the thoughts, feelings, and chaotic sexuality of a vulnerable and isolated protagonist. To read A Girl as a Half-Formed Thing is to plunge inside its narrator's head, experiencing her world firsthand. This isn't always comfortable, but it's always a revelation. Touching on everything from family violence to sexuality and the personal struggle to remain intact in times of intense trauma, McBride writes with singular intensity, acute sensitivity, and mordant wit. A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing is moving, funny, and alarming. It's a book you will never forget.
Hmm.
So what do you think? Have you forgotten about this one?
Oh.
Intense trauma?
I want to just try to explain this book. I should first start by saying that I appreciate experimental fiction, but there's a line that is difficult to stay back from where experimental just turns into a gimmick. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, I've had some positive experiences. Like, I was thinking about A Clockwork Orange, where you have to kind of get into the feeling of the book with its words that are made up. But it's like you can get into it and you can live in that world. Then there were books like, I read the entire book of Umbrella by Will Self that was on the Booker shortlist a few years ago. And you never knew where the sentences started or who was talking. And there would be things in italics for no reason. And it would go backwards and forwards in time. I just wanted to kill myself. So there's a range for me. And this one was pushing my range a little bit because it's relentless in how the language works. There are a lot of sentence fragments. A lot of words out of order from how we usually speak English. And it's not like she just does it some of the time, like when the girl is thinking, because everything comes from the girl's perspective. So it's almost like the long stream of consciousness in her head interpreting the things that are happening. So let me read just a little bit.
Okay.
So you can kind of get the idea. Suddenly, she's all here, mother. She, with scalding prayers, forgotten her old lash phone calls. Am I not here? I. Give me a good punch on my face. Stop. It's fine now. It's fine now. Isn't that why you came? To pick up. Bits and pieces. Let her do her thing. Name of the Father, but shh. Lead us not into temptation. That's right. All very well. I. So I won't utter a single. No. I will. Do this. I will do this for you because I can. Sorry, I can't do much more than that. I don't even know, like, in what tone to read it in. It's so choppy, you know. Mm-hmm. I think I read, the book's only 200 pages long. I read the first 20 pages and had to start over because I realized that I hadn't absorbed anything. I didn't know what was going on.
Wow.
And it starts off when she's 2 years old. So I thought, oh, well, maybe she'll grow out of it. She's 2 and her brother is 5 and he has a brain tumor. And so at first in the childhood story, she'll get older and the language gets a little bit better, but it still remains choppy like this. And then some really traumatic things happen and it's like she reverts to it. So you get to a point in the book where for a while, some of the sentences are full sentences, but still not all. And then like you can tell just through the language and the words and what's being put together that she's very agitated, almost like nervous breakdown scenario.
And what do you feel like the purpose of writing in that way is? Is she, well, I mean, what's the point of it? Is she just thinking, you know, this is the girl thinking live as I'm just trying to, you know, what did you think?
Well, I guess it would have made more sense to me if this had been the brother with the brain tumor, who maybe didn't have a complete, you know, intelligent thought, you know, a lack of connection between the sides of his brain or something. But it's definitely from her perspective, and she goes through school and everything. And she has a job. So, you know, it's not like she's mentally deficient or anything. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm not really sure. I mean, the whole thing just feels so jerky. And so you have to, it's kind of like, you know, the last book, you had to read between the lines of dialogue to figure out the situation. This, you have to read into everything. And what you read, once you get there, it's a very sad story. They have a single mother. The girl is kind of neglected because the boy requires so much attention, and very bad things happen to her. And the whole time you're like, well, what is her mother doing? Why isn't anyone stopping these things from happening? It's awful. And then as an adult, she just doesn't ever get out of the patterns that she's in. So I just didn't enjoy it, honestly. I felt like I appreciated what she was attempting, but I was glad it wasn't any longer than it was. It just
didn't quite work for you.
Yeah, by the end, I was like, I don't want to be reading this anymore. And it's partly the language and how much I had to focus, because it required 100% concentration every word. Mm-hmm. But it was also just the story that was happening, too, was so negative and destructive. And, you know, there wasn't any positive element in it. Yeah,
that's tough to read. Yep.
It was, so I'm not sure I would necessarily recommend it.
A half-formed thing.
Girl is a half-formed thing.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a very positive statement, does it?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Yeah, it sounds, yeah. Yep, rough. So, those are the six.
Those are
the six. So it sounds like overall, though, it was a very positive experience to read all of them.
Well, yeah. And even with this last author, I would still be interested in seeing what else she wrote, because cool. This is her first novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very natural when you're young and you're starting out to be very experimental. And I think that underneath that is a very strong voice, even if it's disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
So I would still want to try something else that she had written, you know?
Oh, good.
In fact, I think all of these authors, I would read something else by them. There wasn't anyone that I was like, nope.
That's cool. Yeah. Yeah. Just the Wikipedia page just shows she's won a Goldsmith's Prize for this and a Folio Prize shortlist. And then the Bailey's Women's Prize.
I don't know what either of those are.
Uh-oh. More lists. The Goldsmith Prize is a British literary award founded in 2013. It is for fiction that opens up new possibilities for the novel form.
Yeah, that would definitely qualify.
It is sponsored by Goldsmiths, University of London, in association with the New Statesman, and has a £10,000 remuneration. Good for her.
Wow.
Good for her. And the Folio Prize is a literary award sponsored by the London publisher, the Folio Society. It is given to an English language book of fiction published in the UK by an author from any country. The first award was in March of 2014, so it's brand new.
Yeah, these are both really new awards.
Yeah, how funny. Very cool.
I noticed I was poking around in Goodreads just trying to find out more information about her.
Mm-hmm.
I found out a lot more about Audrey McGee than I was able to find out about McBride. Mm-hmm. But the only other book that she's in is an anthology of like intentionally disturbing
oh, really?
Fiction. Yeah. Wow. So I thought that was funny. It is definitely, I've seen this trend in other, I mean, not everyone who's young and female writes just intentionally disturbing stuff, but there are a handful of writers where that kind of becomes how they make their mark.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it is I think they're trying to say, you know, it doesn't just have to be men that write disturbing things. Look at us. So, hey, there you are.
There you are.
It worked.
Yeah. Excellent.
So do you want to know who I want to win?
I absolutely do. So is there a clear favorite in your opinion?
Absolutely.
something really clear. You're not even like, oh, it's between these two. It's really, oh, this one's going to be the best. Okay.
Yep. I want Americana to win.
Americana. All right.
Mm-hmm. And I think if I were to pick a second, just, you never know what judges are going to do, right? I think I would pick Burial Rites.
Great.
Just because it was such a different story to tell. But I think that Americana is the best novel.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right.
So the Reading Envy Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction Award goes to...
We'll make a plaque or something. Hmm. That's great. We'll send him a bottle of Bailey's.
Yeah. I bet that's part of the award. Bailey's for life.
I'm sure. I hope so.
The funny thing now is if you go to the Bailey's website, which I was poking around for recipes the other day, they say that they are a drink for women.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Dang, now I can't have it anymore because my masculinity is threatened.
But hopefully you can still read female writers.
Yes, that I can do. That I can do. Yeah. Well, this has been fascinating.
There's a wide range.
Yeah, I'm listening to all these descriptions. These are definitely things I would read.
Yeah.
Yep. So great. It's funny. I'm looking at the cover for A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. I don't know if you read it in...
I have the paperback.
The paperback? Yeah, it looks like something from the 70s.
I know, doesn't it?
Yeah. Was that intentional? Does it happen in the 70s at all?
You know, I don't know if there is an obvious time period or not.
It just looks like a...
I don't specifically remember.
Looks like a 1970s paperback.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really funny to pick it up because mine is actually so shiny, but it looks old.
That's cool. Yeah. Maybe that's intentional. I'm sure it's intentional.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Well, this has been a lot of fun.
It has.
Yeah. Do you have anything else you'd like to say about these?
I do not.
Okay. Well, I enjoyed it very much. So thanks very much. Yeah, thanks for reading all these.
Sure. It's my first year reading them before the deadline.
All right. Yeah.
Feeling very proud of myself.
Very interested to see how it turns out.
Me too.
So, all right. And thank you for listening, everybody.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. And we'll see you soon on the podcast. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.